Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
The economic news today is brought to you by five letters, ECB and QE. The European Central Bank gets all quantitative easing on us. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you here on this Thursday, everybody. It is the 4th of September today. It is rare indeed when an interest rate move by a major central bank takes the global economy by surprise. But Mario Draghi and the European Central Bank did just that this morning, lowering a key Eurozone interest rate from really, really low, 0.15% to be precise, to basically zero. And more's the shocker, copying to a degree the U.S. Federal Reserve's bond-buying program known as quantitative easing. From New York, Marketplace's Sabri Benishour gets us going.
Let us imagine Europe's economy as a patient.
He doesn't have an hour, Jackson, he doesn't.
Recently, its condition has deteriorated. Second quarter GDP growth flatlined.
The Eurozone economy is failing to recover the way that, the UK economy or the US have been recovering.
Andrew Lillico is head of Europe economics.
You have countries with 25% and up unemployment, still very much trapped in the depression.
And the inflation rate has been creeping towards zero each month. If it hits zero, it could enter a deflationary spiral. So the European Central Bank acted. It lowered interest rates, penalized banks for not lending, and said it would buy assets to inject stimulus into the economy. But ER doctors act quickly. The ECB, not so much.
It really should have done it probably 4 or 5 years ago.
Making decisions at the ECB is a little bit like herding cats, says Abdur Chowdhury. He teaches economics at Marquette University.
The governing council that makes the decision, they have one member for each of the Eurozone countries. And these members look at national interest first and the interest of the Eurozone second.
But, he says,
better late than never.
What does this mean for the U.S.? Mark Chandler with Brown Brothers Harriman says European investors might be tempted to invest in U.S. bonds.
So it makes the U.S. look like a high yielder. That makes the U.S. more attractive.
And with the euro falling on this news, European goods will be cheaper for Americans to buy, though American exports may suffer. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
Speaking of the American economy, there was a time back before the crash when we in the business and economic press would do stories every couple of months about big gains in worker productivity and how that was helping the economy grow. Then, of course, came the crash. This morning, the Commerce Department did a report, a rise in productivity last quarter, but still, American productivity just ain't what it used to be. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer has that story.
This is not your father's productivity rate. Back before the recession, productivity increases averaged 2 to 3% a year. But we've been stuck with around 1% for the past few years. Still,
1% today is not the 1% of 2006 before we went into the recession.
That's Christopher Rupke, chief economist of MUFG Union Bank. He says before the recession, a 1% productivity rate would have been awful because we were in that crazy housing bubble. It skewed productivity up. After the bubble burst, productivity skewed down. So if you think about it, 1% isn't so bad, says James Kraft. He teaches business administration at the University of Pittsburgh.
Given what we've experienced in terms of some of the problems in the economy and its recovery and so forth, I think that is reasonable at this point in time.
And here's another thing to think about. It's harder to measure productivity now. It was easy when Microsoft Word first came along, according to Doug Handler, chief U.S. economist at IHS Global Insight.
The big benefit was, of course, secretaries don't have to retype memos here. I've been taking advantage of the word processing here.
But Handler says some things haven't changed. Companies still need to hire good people and spring for the latest technology, even if they're not sure how it'll affect productivity. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Oh, they tried today. Traders couldn't quite eke out the win. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Venture capital is a phrase most commonly associated with sparkly new high-tech startups, not so much with a more mature industry like healthcare. But as you know, there are all kinds of changes happening in the American healthcare economy, and VCs want in. Aledade is a VC-backed company, and it is teaming up with independent primary care doctors to make money by saving money. From the Health Desk at WHYY Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein explains.
It's another afternoon for Dr. Rebecca Jaffe as she bops around her exam rooms.
How are you?
Good. How are you?
Okay.
For 30 years, Jaffe's worked in rooms like this, running her family medicine practice here in Wilmington, Delaware.
Newborns and their parents and their parents and their parents. So up to four generations of a family. We call it womb to tomb.
To Jaffe, womb to tomb is a pledge she makes to her patients. To Aledade CEO Dr. Farzad Mosashari, that represents a business opportunity.
When a health plan sends a video about nutrition for patients with diabetes, 4% of the time people open that link. When their primary care doctor sends it, 95% of the time we know that they click and open that video.
Today, the healthcare industry spends billions trying to buy that persuasive power a physician like Dr. Jaffe enjoys. See, if you can control or at least influence patient decisions, you can limit healthcare spending, which has become high-stakes business. Mosashari says, imagine a 30-something recreational runner who comes in complaining of knee pain and wants an MRI.
The primary care physician acting in the patient's best interest and the patient really feeling, if they're not recommending an MRI for me, it's because I don't need one and I trust my primary care physician.
Aledade is betting the relationships you find in these independent mom-and-pop practices will help control healthcare costs more than most anything else. Already, the company is working with 100 docs to form what are called accountable care organizations, or ACOs. That's a jargony way of saying the less spending overall, while ensuring quality, the more money doctors earn under the federal government's Medicare Shared Savings Program. Mosashari says Aledade will be a savvy consultant with cash.
I'm going to give them what they need, whether it's data, whether it's capital, whether it's tools, whether it's technology.
In exchange, Aledade keeps 40% of any savings. The company is being backed by the venture capital firm Venrock, which hit healthcare grand slams with Athena Health and Castlight Health, both multi-billion dollar businesses today. Venrock's Brian Roberts sees that kind of possibility for Aledade too. Even though the practices are small independents, 100 docs like Jaffe call the shots on nearly $1 billion of referrals, tests, and hospitalizations every year. The trouble, says Roberts, is many of them don't realize it.
Today, those primary care physicians have no control over and no incentive for control over those downstream dollars. And so to me, that's the place where magic can happen.
That magic will often mean offering same-day appointments, checking on patients just discharged from the hospital, extending hours to help avoid trips to the ER. Similar programs in Massachusetts and Florida suggest this is a winning formula. Dr. Jaffe is fine if Aledade makes bundles, even if she's doing most of the hard work. She's sick of hitting healthcare walls, like recently when no repair company would fix her 101-year-old patient's wheelchair.
I have known this woman for more than 35 years, and I want what's best for her. And what was best for her was for us to do our utmost at getting that seat fixed. I went so far as asking my husband if he would consider doing it.
Jaffe worried the woman would get hurt trying to learn some new doodad of a device, but that was the only choice.
In less than 2 days, she fell, broke her leg, and is now sitting in a nursing home.
It all goes back to Jaffe's womb-to-tomb pledge. Whatever profits Aledade makes is worth it if this company can make these sorts of healthcare pileups go away, something she knows she can't do on her own. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
Football starts tonight. Packers at the Seahawks. The game is on NBC tonight, CBS for the other Thursdays this season. So, over at ABC, they're doing a little counter-programming, and its name is Shonda Rhimes. She of Grey's Anatomy and Scandal, shows that have changed the face of primetime by casting more women and people of color. Rimes is going to have a new crime show on ABC's Thursday night lineup starting in a couple of weeks. And although they might not say it out loud, ABC executives are surely thinking must-see TV. Marketplace's Queen of Kim has that story.
ABC has had a rough couple of years when it comes to prime time. Brad Adgate is an analyst at Horizon Media.
Last year, they were last in their belts, 18 to 49.
That's dead last. But
when it came to women, 18 to 49, you know, they were second.
And Adgate says Shonda Rhimes is credited in large part for that success. Rhimes is a show creator and showrunner who champions strong female leads in a diverse cast. And Adgate says that formula appeals to women, who now make up 65% of the network's audience. He says with network ratings sliding, it's not surprising that ABC would double down on its niche status.
I have
one overwhelming feeling.
I love
Shonda
Rhimes.
That's an advertisement for the Thursday night lineup, and the characters are saying, I love Shonda Rhimes, while the words flash across the screen. Cynthia Littleton is the TV editor for Variety, and she says while there have been powerful showrunners in the past, this may be the first time a network promoted one as a star.
This branding and the three shows stacked on one night, that is absolutely a function of social media and how it has turned Shonda Rhimes into a marketable star.
Littleton says Rhimes was masterful in using Twitter to promote shows and make herself a star with viewers. But will this branding work? Joe Adalian is a TV editor for Vulture.com.
Network TV these days is a game of trying to do better than you did last year, which is hard to do.
Adalian says by that measure, Thursday's strategy will work. The night is already filled with two hit shows, and with Rhimes' star status, the third one has a good chance of becoming one too. I'm Queen of Kim for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Yes, they are coming to work on a tiny movie that is way beneath them, but at least we have some precedent of saying these movies actually pay off.
Oh, so that's how indie filmmaking works. Good to know. But first, let's do the numbers. Well, there you go. The Dow Industrials gave back 8 points today, just a fraction of 1%, really closed at 17,069. The NASDAQ down 10 points, 0.2%, finished at 4,562. The S&P 500 off 3 points, 0.1%. Ended things at 1997. Where, oh, where to start today? Well, how about this? A court ruling in the biggest ever environmental disaster in American history. A federal judge brought the hammer down on BP, calling the company, quote, grossly negligent for its role in the 2010 Gulf of Mexico oil spill. That means BP could be on the hook for $18 billion with a B or more in fines. BP shares in the U.S. tumbled about 6%. If you do the math, that's about $9 billion in market cap. BP, of course, says it is going to appeal immediately. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.46%. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. In Washington, the Labor Department releases the August jobs report. The U.S. Open tennis tournament continues in New York. And tomorrow is apparently Be Late for Something Day. So hit that snooze button a few times. I'm Michelle Filippi.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. All right, so here's a seemingly random question. Last time you stayed in a hotel, how closely did you look over your bill when you checked out? I ask because hotels are going the way airlines and mobile phone companies have gone the past couple of years, adding lots of little fees, fees that will total more than $2 billion across the hospitality industry this year. Sam Harnett adds up the nickel and diming.
Hotels have gotten creative with their fees. Colin Johnson keeps a list.
No, we've got all kinds of fees, haven't we? Early check-in fees, there can be gym fees, baggage holding if you want to leave your baggage, Wi-Fi that could be...
Johnson teaches fees. Hospitality management at San Francisco State University.
There's all kinds of fees coming out, even if you want to put your own stuff then in the minibars, which I thought was the most creative.
Hotels have had some rough years. First the recession, now rental websites like Airbnb. Fees offer some extra profit, and, well, why not raise them? Airlines do it, and passengers make do with a pack of peanuts.
I think some of the businesses honestly just don't care.
Carl Winston directs the hospitality school at San Diego State. He says these fees aren't due to bad times. They're the product of big data. Hotels now know better what we will and won't pay for.
Yeah, they're really able to predict consumer behavior in a way that they had no possibility of doing in the past.
Lots of little fees give hotels more information to profile us, to squeeze out every dollar. And by stripping out all the perks, hotels keep the initial room price low. If they bring you in the door with that, Winston says, they won't waste what's called perishable inventory.
An airline or a hotel can only sell its seat or its bed today. If they don't sell it today, it's gone.
So gripe all you want about the fees. As long as you keep coming back for the cheap rooms, they won't be going anywhere. In San Francisco, I'm Sam Harnett for Marketplace.
The oil boom out in North Dakota has brought tens of thousands of people to a pretty rural part of the country. So now there is a shortage of housing. There's a shortage of restaurants. There's a shortage of workers for non-oil-related businesses. And at the end of the day, there is a shortage of things to do. Some, though, have brought hobbies with them. Tinkering with their pickups and showing them off is one of them. Independent producer Todd Melby has been bringing us some of the voices from the oil fields in his series Black Gold Boom. Here's another voice and a hobby called rolling coal.
My name is Mark Pyatt. We are at Killer Diesel Performance here in Williston, North Dakota. The rolling coal is the overfueling of a diesel engine on purpose with the intent to smoke out whomever might be behind them or around them. Rolling coal is more than a thing. It's, I almost call it a movement. It's kind of like the liberals versus the conservatives, the stuffed shirts versus the blue collars. But there seems to be a bit of a fun hatred between diesel trucks and fuel-efficient tree huggers, as some would put that. So sometimes they do it to offend people. I think generally if anybody ever stopped to talk to somebody, they would find it's just good people having fun. But it has become quite a movement. You could spend as little as $350 to buy a tuner and roll coal without doing anything else. So it's very affordable to have fun and roll coal and upset your neighbors. I think it's always been since the dawn of time. You know, if it wasn't rolling coal, it was stealing cookies when mom told you not to. If it wasn't that, it was your neighbor telling you to get out of your yard, so you jump back in. I mean, as the young people of this nation, we've never really changed. We always want to do what we shouldn't do. I don't know that people shouldn't be rolling coal because I find no real harm in it, but it seems to be taboo, so anything that's taboo, people want to do it more. And I think that's the movement behind the rolling coal.
You and Calvin, it's this truck.
Todd's series Black Gold Boom is an initiative of Prairie Public and the Association for Independence in Radio. Making movies isn't for the faint of heart. You got to raise money, you struggle to keep some modicum of creative control, all the while negotiating the twists and turns of a Byzantine industry. Mark Duplass does that and more while writing, producing, and directing independent films with his brother Jay. Cyrus and The Puffy Chair are two that you might have heard of. Oh, and he acts a little bit on the side, too. Season 6 of The League on the FXX network debuted last night. Mark, thanks so much for coming into the studio.
Thanks for having me.
What is it exactly that you do? Because you kind of do everything.
The way I started was as a writer, director, you know, in a team with my brother Jay, and that's still the bulk of what I do. I've kind of fallen into becoming an actor because I was the only one not holding a camera in our little movie, so I would just be in front of it. And then likewise, I kind of fell into being a producer of independent film because you can't go out and sell your independent movies as easily as you could before. And I just sort of started coming up with new models and new ways of making movies that seem to work, and that means you're a producer.
One of the – in fact, the main way you do it is low budget is pejorative, I think, but you do it, shall we say, with a very light footprint.
Yeah, I would venture micro budget.
I read somewhere you did a movie for like $15,000.
Yeah, I mean, our first movie that really hit was this movie called The Puffy Chair that was a Sundance movie from 2005. And we did. We made it for $15,000 with, you know, some of our parents' money and some of our money. we developed this school of filmmaking that we call the Available Materials School of Filmmaking, which is you sort of look around, and if you and I were going to make a film, we'd be like, wow, we got these three cool microphones. There's that great clock in the corner. This is a nice, interesting space. Let's make a two-hander that's a lot like My Dinner with Andre. Wow. And find some way to make it sustainable. In this way, you are guaranteeing yourself the ability to make a movie as opposed to writing a script and then going, where are we going to get a spaceship? We don't have money for that. And so for that movie, I had a van, I had two apartments, I had some things, and so I threw them into the kettle, and then we made a movie with it.
If you had more money, mm-hmm. if you could write that script with a spaceship and then get that movie made, would you be a less creative person, if that makes any sense?
It's a great question. There are a couple of answers to it. Right now, I get a lot of money to make a TV show for HBO that my brother and I just finished our first season. It's called Togetherness. Yep. I am not a less creative person on that show because of the form. Television is not afraid of singular voices. HBO is a brand and a subscription service. I am one corner of that brand for them, and they let me do whatever I want to do with a lot of money. That is rare. HBO and all these other places are going to figure out they don't have to pay us that well soon enough that we would do it anyway. Yeah, everybody be quiet. Nobody listen. But in the film world, it's very, very different. Once you get into a level of $5 million or above on your budget, you are essentially a commodity. It is your duty, in my opinion, to serve that commodity. So you don't go and make a Marvel movie trying to make a piece of art. You're going to make everybody unhappy.
It's a fiduciary responsibility.
That's basically how I feel.
I would ask you why you're still doing movies, but I guess you got that slice of HBO, so you've got that TV thing going.
Yeah, I like having a combination of things, but again, I love the form of movies. You know, it doesn't take as much time to make a movie. You know, I just finished a movie called The One I Love, and it was a perfect example of my sort of smaller budget filmmaking that works perfectly for a film.
Except you have Elizabeth Moss, for crying out loud, mm-hmm. from Mad Men, and Ted Danson, who's no chump.
Let's face it, Mark Duplass is in that movie, too.
Well, you know, let's set him aside.
He's there.
He's fine. Yeah. But I mean, it's not like you can – I don't know. Maybe you can. You call him up and say, listen, I'm doing this really tiny little film, and I need you for a week and a half.
Well, let's, you know, not to get too crazy, but if you break down the economics of it, and this is what I do as a producer with the agents, you know, someone's making a $5 million movie, right? Yeah. They go to a movie star like Elizabeth Moss and they say, we're going to offer you Schedule F, which is a $60,000 offer. Then what happens is that budget gets knocked down.
Is that actually true? I mean, you know,
that's what they get. That's what they get. It's 65 grand.
All right.
Then they get knocked down to a $3.5 million budget, and they go back to Elizabeth Moss, who's already in love with the movie, and they say, I can't pay you Schedule F anymore. I'm going to pay you Scale, which is about $3,000 a week, and I'm going to give you a point on the back end of the movie, which with creative accounting in these big companies, you're never going to see. Okay. Yeah. So I know that because I'm an actor. I get these offers too. So I go to that agent and I say, okay, so here's the deal. Elizabeth Moss is now working on this $5 million movie for 4 weeks. She's making 12 grand. Here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to pay you the minimum of what I can pay you, the low budget model scale. Everybody on my movie is going to make $100 a day, whether it's Elizabeth Moss, whether it's a PA, whether it's Ted Danson, whether it's
Mark Duplass,
whoever. Everybody's going to make that, but I'm going to give you big points on the back end of this movie. And because we've made it so cheaply, we're going to get into profit really soon, and there's going to be real points. And they say, well, how do I know these points are going to work?
Yeah.
And then I hand them the documents, and I say, well, here is Safe Dinner Guaranteed and Your Sister's Sister and Hump Day and The Puffy Chair, and here's what everybody made. And it dwarfs the Schedule F offer that they were going to make in the first place. Yes, they are coming to work on a tiny movie that is way beneath them, but at least we have some precedent of saying – these movies actually pay off. And more importantly, you have an ownership in this. You have a real stake in this, not just from a financial perspective, but from a, you know, a spiritual and
the artistic side.
Yeah, the artistic side, yeah.
Of all the things you do, right, you write, you direct, you act, you produce, you executive produce, all of that stuff, what's your favorite thing?
Nothing is more rewarding at the end of the day than writing and directing movies or TV with my brother, because we've been doing this for years. But in that way, it's a lot like being a parent where – you know, it is so stressful and so exhausting. Of course, you see your baby's sleeping face at night and you love it. Yeah. Acting in a movie is much more like being, you know, the fun drunk uncle that shows up with Oreos for 3 hours and then you leave and the parents have to put the children to bed. I also love the producing side because I like the game.
Mark Duplass, thanks very much for coming to the studio.
Thanks for having me.
This final note on the way out today, useful perhaps for devotees of Yelp. A federal court of appeals in San Francisco has ruled that the company can, if it so chooses, raise or lower the rating of a business on the site, depending on whether or not that business advertises on Yelp. Such a move would not be extortion, the court said, which is what the lawsuit at issue had claimed. Yelp, of course, says it would never do such a thing anyhow. All right, we're done. That is Marketplace from 8 p.m. this Thursday. Today, the Dow gave back 8 points, just a fraction of 1%. The NASDAQ down 0.2%. The S&P 500 off 3 points, more than a 0.1% there. John Buckley, Kim Bowie, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, Cindy Johnston, George Judson, Dave Shaw, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.